Thank you. My name is Clint Hodges. I'm an alcoholic. There's still some chairs available up here. If you're standing in the back and want to sit down, there's maybe a half a dozen chairs. Okay. I'm glad that I was included here tonight. I want you to know that the meeting will not be here next month. Was that covered? Thank you. Kelly picked me up at the airport today, and I thank her for that. I was, some of it gets interesting. Maybe it was 2 years ago, I called my office for messages, and the receptionist said, well, you sure have an interesting life. I said, what does that mean? She said, well, I didn't know you were going to be in Cincinnati this weekend. I said, yeah, I am, as a matter of fact. How do you know that? And she said, well, there's a message here from somebody that said the guy that's going to pick you up at the airport in Cincinnati on Friday, well, he's got a wooden leg, and he'll be holding a big book. And and sure enough, he had a wooden leg, and he was carrying a big book, and he was at the airport to meet me. And so, and he'd lost that leg in a motorcycle accident. He'd been a Hell's Angel, and we chatted a little bit, went down to the parking lot, and he was driving a Pinto, which I was very grateful for, because it was raining in Minneapolis. We had a lot of fun. He had an earring in his ear. I told everybody that was really not an earring, that the Ohio State Wildlife Commission had caught him sleeping in the park and tagged his ear and sent his ass to AA. But we had a lot of fun. In fact, when he took me back Sunday, he had a gift for me. It was in a brown paper bag. I opened it up, and it was his first wooden foot that he got. And it's like, you kind of wonder, you know, a lot of things go through your mind when you, how am I going to get this through the little deal at the gate? Yeah. So anyway, I thank you for picking me up at the airport. I appreciate that a lot. And I appreciate being here. And I appreciate being asked to come over. This is a wonderful meeting, and you got some great speakers coming up. And you've had some great ones up here, and I hope that this monthly get together is a great, enthusiastic chip. They call that book a chip. Chip of a book, this little chip of a book. And our meeting, I think of our meeting in Los Angeles, the Pacific Group, as a little chip of a meeting, and this is a chip of a meeting. And it's all part of a huge thing. And I really believe something else tonight. I don't think we're here together by accident. If you're new here, those four people that stood up in their first 30 days and anybody else that may be in the new in Alcoholics Anonymous, I don't believe you're here by accident. I just don't believe that. We are brought together. We are led to this place. We are called to this place by forces that seem to come into play at the point where we admit powerlessness. At the point where we really, at least with reference to booze, we admit powerlessness. And it's a strange kind of admission. Our prayers do not sound like prayers. when we're new. They're too profane and too angry, you know. But there are prayers. They are prayers. I can still remember years ago hearing a gal named Gail, who has since died sober, but she was at the podium in Los Angeles at a meeting, and she was talking about the alcoholic's prayer. She was talking about coming up. She just captured me, because she looked great at the podium, and she was about my age, and she was sober longer than me, and she looked kind of cynical, and I thought, you know, if she's going for it, maybe there's something here. And she's talking about the alcoholic's prayer, and it, on the way to getting how she said the prayer, she described coming out of a blackout in a little apartment in Hollywood, and she was sitting on the mantel over the fireplace with her cat. And there was a little cat food and vodka up there, a little something for everybody, and, you know. And as the story unfolded, what she was sitting up there because there was 8 inches of water on the floor. And that was because she'd started to take a bath last Tuesday and the whole deal got away from her somehow. And I'm liking her better every minute, you know. Yes, Gail, you're my kind of girl. You won't criticize my drinking. But her prayer touched me, because it seems like a silly little prayer, but I've said the prayer so many times and didn't even know it was a prayer. The prayer, her prayer, the alcoholic's prayer is, from her story, Jesus, God, what's wrong with me? What's wrong with me? That prayer. We baffle everybody, but we are so confused. And if you're new here and you're confused about the events in your life, and if they've been bizarre and ugly and irrational, and if they've been hurtful, and if they've been unpredictable, the fact that you're sitting in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous tonight might very well seem like just one more bizarre thing that's happened to you on the way, you know. I mean, it's hard to get caught up in the splendor of a description of doors in Tracy used as tables, you know. You go, doors. But that's the chip of the meeting in Tracy and how it started and the fierce loyalty to it. But we're new and we don't quite really, you know. But I welcome you here. I welcome you here. There'll be so much that goes on that won't quite grab you. I mean, a bail bondsman brought me to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm like, what? In Glendale, California, in the little room up over the laundry, up a long flight of stairs hung to the side of the building, and I'm in there in chair and tables like these. Thank God they'd gone through the door stage and had real tables. I don't know if I could have gotten sober on doors. I'm kidding. And they had the steps on the wall. And there was all this reference to God. And they seemed like nice people. And now they're doing the thing about God. And I'm pleased for you. You know, that's so nice. And they look like And see, there's a big problem. Cindy talked about choosing not to drink. They talked like that, some of them. I don't drink no matter what. And you know, I drink no matter what. No matter what, I drink. And they looked like they could quit drinking. And in fact, it seemed as if they had quit, you know? And I had tried to quit. And I can't quit. God, that was such an amazing thing to discover. I always knew that if I really wanted to quit, and if it got bad enough, I would quit. And I did. I told everybody, I'm quitting. I was on active duty at Camp Pendle. I told my commander. I told my wife. I told the chaplain. I told the psychiatrist I was seeing in town. I told the base psychologist, who turned out later to be a dermatologist, but I told him anyway. Yeah. I got a little something going with a guy over here, yeah. And 6 weeks later, I was shocked to be drinking again. Because I knew I could quit. And I quit a lot. I got to be regular at quitting. I would quit several times a day. This is the last half pint I'm going to need. That's why I bought a half a pint. And I go down for four more before noon. And you looked like you could quit, and I knew I could not quit. The bail bondsman that brought me to Alcoholics Anonymous knew I could not quit. He had bailed me out a lot of times. And he took me there. He didn't know what would happen. He'd never taken anybody before, and nor to my knowledge has he taken anybody since. I call him every year on my birthday, and I thank him for bringing me here. In August, I'll call him again. In August, on the 14th, it will be 30 years for me. Yeah, that's... And I used to say, God willing. But you know what? He's willing. The question is, am I willing? And I am willing. I love this life. I love it here. I love it, and the last 6 years have been the sweetest of all. And they're getting sweeter. But when I came here, you looked like you had what it takes to quit. And I know that I can't quit, and you do this thing about God, and you do the meetings, and they take pride and pleasure and satisfaction and laughter and things that I'm not connecting with. And it's a place to hang out. It's a place, take your pack off and rest for a while. And if you're anything like me, you have the secret notion that this is about a 6 week deal for you. And you'll be on your way someplace else. And I understand that, and it isn't true. I did not sign on for 30 years. I did not know that was my last drink on August 14th, 1966. I did not know. Chuck used to say, it's just as well. You know, I mean, if we'd have known that was our last drink, we'd have had two. And you'd have another speaker up here tonight, I'll tell you that. But it seems like it's about quitting, doesn't it? But if I could quit, I wouldn't have come here. Chapter 5 was read here tonight. Dean read chapter 5. And the steps were listed. These improbable, unlikely, badly phrased, weird steps. These impossible steps were read. And we come to love those steps. And we come to practice them and incorporate them into our lives. We come to take that big book and place it in the middle of our life and leave it there. And step one, if it were about quitting, if you were required to quit, how would it go? Step one, quit. Come on, knock it off, goddammit. The thing that we have to get is we're out of power. We can't quit. There has to be. See, we have placed ourselves beyond human aid. And it's a weird kind of a thing. I had my first drink when I was 16. 2 years earlier, I had stood at the low rent part of the cemetery in Billings, Montana, and they put my mother in that grave. And that was the end of a very turbulent time. I didn't cry that day. I didn't say goodbye. I didn't grieve. I didn't know any of that. I knew that I had, since about age 7, been so angry with my mother and with my grandmother. Somebody in here tonight grew up in a home of abuse. Somebody in here tonight has held on to the notion, as I did, that the abuse permanently harmed me. That the beatings and the humiliation and the dark closets for way too long and the no food for way too long. The harshness of that goofy kind of a life, all founded on some on talk about God, it seemed to have crimped me from my point of view. And I thought I would always be contracted and crimped. I thought I would always, in the prophet it says, you will finally cry all your tears, laugh all of your laughter, and I knew I had never wept all of my tears. I had never laughed all of my laughter. I knew, I live a three-quarter life. I don't fully commit. I don't fully enjoy. I don't fully do anything because I have been contracted and crimped in some weird way. And I didn't even know I knew that about myself for a long time. And before I forget to say it, I will tell you that it is not true. At least in my case, the healing is complete. And my life is full and rich. And I laugh my laughter. And I cry my tears. And I have abundance in my life. And I have God in my life. But I thought it would never happen to me. And if you, and I would invite you, if you're new, relatively new, come from that kind of a background, to just stick that in your hip pocket and take another look as you go along. Because we need not limp. If we think we have to limp, we will limp. But we need not limp. I don't think we're brought here. I don't think the fact that we are here together, I think that ends it. Whatever call you answered to be here, whatever strange and weird series of events brought you to this place with these people tonight, will take you home. It will take you home. You are not here by accident. And it was true for me. I got up to that club in Glendale in July that year, 1966, and I stayed sober for 3 weeks, and I was drunk for two, and I came back on the 14th of August, and the guy that was in the club that night, that afternoon, and I was so ashamed because I thought I was humiliated that I'd gotten drunk again. I was humiliated to discover again that I can't quit. I thought I'd let you down. And the guy said to me, and I told him, and he said, are you alcoholic? And I said, yeah, I've been an alcoholic about a month now. He let that go. He let it go. But he said, well, if you are an alcoholic of our type, you didn't let us down just because you drank, you think you're... Yeah, he said, no, you're going to drink. You've placed yourself beyond human aid. You're going to drink. You're going to drink no matter what. He said, you didn't even surprise us when you got drunk. And he said, if you want to surprise us, get a job. That would surprise us. Drinking, no, shit, no, you're going to drink, pal. You're going to drink. But he was kind about it, you know. He just kind of let me have the dignity of fact. Man, he laid it out there and he said, you're beyond human aid. You are gone. And I was 29, and I got it. I mean, I knew how hopeless my condition was. And that Friday night, I was back in that same club, that Alano Club in Glendale, California, and had been to a meeting every day. And I went up to a guy and I said, how do you get to sleep at night if you don't drink? How? He said, do you really want to get to sleep? And I said, yeah. He said, well, where do you live? And I said, well, I live down the street. I didn't tell him I lived in a garage. I lived in a garage with three other guys. Double garage. We had plenty of room. We were not crowded. He said, well, I'll tell you what. He didn't know about the garage, but he knew I lived down the street. He said, do you live alone? And I said, yeah. He said, make your bed. You want to sleep tonight? When you get home, make your bed. And I just kind of looked at him and he said, yeah, really, put clean sheets on your bed. And I wondered how he knew about those sheets. The psychiatrist didn't even know about the sheets. If you're new here, these people know stuff. You got to watch them, man. And then he said, after you get the bed made, get into it, say a little prayer to yourself. Oh, right. First we got housekeeping hints and now the prayer deal. He gave me the prayer, God before us, who can be against us? Well, I knew from church that that was St. Paul. I never liked St. Paul. And it seemed like such a dumb prayer. And I got back to the little garage that night in my little cot, and the thing I could not get out of my mind was he knew about those sheets. And I found some clean sheets in a box, and I put them on the little mattress. And I got in there, and I did not want to lay awake and stare at the ceiling till 2 or 3 or 4. I was afraid. Those are awful, long, terrible nights. Endless, endless. That little dial on the clock radio just, you hang on for about an hour and you look and it's been 7 minutes, you know. God. And so I said his stupid prayer, God before us, who can be again? What? Come on. We used to say it when I was a kid. Now I lay me down to sleep, right? Doesn't help you get to that part about if I should die before I wake. That'll keep you awake a while. Just thinking that through. But I said his stupid prayer because I was out of answers. And I slept all night. I hadn't slept like that in a year. I don't know about the prayer. I don't know about the clean sheets. I know this. On the 14th of August, 1966, I was a drunk. On the 15th of August, 1966, I was sober. I have been sober every day since that time, and I cannot quit. I don't know what prayer I said on the 14th of August. I don't know. I know this. I know I did not earn this deal. I know I did nothing to earn this extraordinary gift of sobriety. We pray. We ask in some profane way. I was so interested when the Freedom of Information Act made some documents from World War II available. Some of them were studied and looked at. There was an Allied invasion at Anzio Beach in Italy. And it was a terrible disaster from a military point of view because the beach was 400 meters deep instead of 100 meters. There was bad weather. There was the aircraft couldn't come in. That was heavily defended. The Axis powers knew the invasion. It was awful. And for 4 days and four long and hideous nights, Allied troops were brought in, dumped out of landing craft, waded ashore to be cut down at the edge of the beach by machine gun fire. And they died there, or they hid behind bodies that were dead or dying. And they finally secured that beach, and the graves registration detail came through, and they picked up bodies and identification and all of that, and also picked up out of cold, dead hands notes and letters and poetry that had been written during those awful days and nights. A letter to a wife or a lover, a poem, a prayer. One prayer touched me. One prayer was, I don't know how you framed your prayer, and I don't know how mine was, but this guy said, God, come. Come now. Come yourself. Do not send your son. This is no place for children. I thought, God. I don't know why he framed it that way, but it seemed to me that I went right to headquarters. You know? It touched me, that prayer, that anguish. Because we go through a death when we come here. And there's a resurrection, there's an Easter morning, but we've been through a death. And it's an agonizing, long, terrible thing. And we think we'll never recover from it, and we do. And we don't, and we just kind of wake up in the midst of something called sobriety. Sobriety. Because we have asked, in whatever profane way we've asked. And so if I have a message, and a good friend of mine from Chicago, Paul, says, if I have a message, it's the message of one beggar talking to another beggar about where the bread is. The bread is here. Because, man, we were out of it. We were out of human resources. We had placed ourselves beyond human aid. And there's another little whack on this that was so interesting. If a guy were to ask me in those days to make a list of the 20 craziest things I ever did around booze, I got such a wonderful list. And I'm sure you do too. And I would go to him with my list. My list would be like that first drink at that high school party when I was 16. And when the party was over, I was 29 and living in the garage, you know that? And the party was over. And that Christmas Eve in jail in Portland. That dental school mess. I went to dental school for 2 years. They finally threw me out. It was just terrible. We had a clinic on Saturday morning, and I'd show up there and supposed to have some guy in the chair doing something with him, but I'd gotten drunk on Friday night, and I'd slam back a couple of Dexamil ampules and coffee, and I'm jerking and twitching around, and they'd just come out with that new high-speed air-driven handpiece, and I'm just... You could wipe out a quadrant and teeth just twitching, you know. They hate to hear you say whoops when you're screwing around. Ooh, man. That would be on my list. I made a set of dentures for a guy the first year I was up there. He came back the second year. He brought his wife, and he'd see me at the end of the clinic bay, and he'd go, say. Something wrong with my teeth. Well, they threw me out of there. So that would be on my list. I drank on Skid Row that summer. Came out of the blackout in a little Skid Row bar. They called them cafes on Burnside Street in Portland because there was pickled pig's feet in there, you know. In case you were watching your diet. And I come out of glass lit like this. It has all of the romance of the lighting in this room. And the cops would come in and out and all of that. And we just drank and you tried not to get in any trouble because it interfered with the drinking. And I came out of a blackout and I'm sitting across a little wooden table from a woman. I had no idea where we'd met. I seem to be kind of with her, you know. She had her things there in bags. I didn't know her name. I didn't know how long we'd been together. I had no idea the nature of our relationship. I would have asked her, but she was sleeping. She had chili on her face, so I knew we'd gone to dinner, you know. That would be on my list, some delicate flower I'd invited to dine that night. Man, we gave up a lot to come here, didn't we? The commander at the Marine Corps Air Station at El Toro on a Monday morning gave me a letter of reprimand and said there isn't any room in the Marine Corps for an alcoholic lieutenant. That'd be on the list. Walking out of his office when he finally dismissed me, I knew his judgment was so bad. I knew I wasn't an alcoholic. I knew one more thing. I knew I needed to drink more than anything else that day. The fitness report that said Lieutenant Hodges consistently fails to live up to the low standards he has set for himself. That'd be on the list. The last time I got arrested for drunk driving when I still had a car and the cop had me touching my nose and doing all that, this was in Glendale. And I read the police report a couple of weeks later and the cop had said, I discontinued the field sobriety test because the suspect was injuring himself. That's on my list. And so I would take the list to the guy and say, here's the thing, the craziest things I ever did. And it would kind of give you an angle about step one, wouldn't it? Powerless over alcohol. I mean, it was largely around booze. And in my handwriting, it drives the point home. And the guy would say, you know, this is a cute list. And I'm sure there's plenty of stuff you didn't put down, like the look on a child's face after you've slapped it. But he said you did not write the craziest thing down you ever did. What would that be? What? The craziest thing that you ever did is not on the list. What? And you did it repeatedly. What? And you did it before you drank. No booze in your system, and you did it again and again. What? You decided to drink again. In the face of this extraordinary mound of evidence that you should never drink, you decided to drink. And I would have to say, yeah, yeah. Seemed like a good idea. See, okay. This time it'll be different. I'm only hurting myself. Somehow I will justify that. And that is the angle that I need to get to the second part of step one, because my life is unmanageable. And I'll tell you why. That's the top of my game with no booze in my system. And I come into Alcoholics Anonymous, and because I have asked for this gift, in whatever way I ask, I'm given the gift, but the mind that I bring in here is the same mind from which I made the decision to drink so many times, a mind with no booze in it. That's a problem. In this book called Alcoholics Anonymous, I don't know where it is. There's one around here, I'm sure. It's got a blue cover on it. You'll spot it. On page 37, it says that my mind lacks proportion and can't think straight. That's a problem. That's a problem. And we evaluate the mind with our mind, and so we don't quite get it somehow, you know? I mean, if a car cuts me off on the freeway and I chase him 10 miles, there's a lack of proportion in there someplace. You ever had a telephone conversation and the other person hung up on you? They have to die, don't they? There's no question about it. Well, there is a question whether they die quickly or slowly, but they're going to die. There's a mind that lacks proportion and can't think straight. That's a problem, because that mind is only connected by rumor to sanity. And we wonder about that second step. And we say things like, was I really insane? And that's never the question. The interesting question is not whether I was insane. The interesting question is, what would sanity look like? At step 10 in that book, it says that every day is the day we carry the vision of God's will into all of our activities. That vision is our vision. It's the only vision we'll ever have. We can't know God's vision for us, but we can form a vision of sanity. I was given an interesting promise. They said, if you can form for yourself a vision of sanity at step 2, and take steps 3 through 9, by the time you get halfway through 9, you will have no more and no less in your life than the vision of sanity you formed at step 2. That's a pretty healthy promise. Came true. But I'm here with an unmanageable life, and I want to go to sanity, whatever my vision of it is. And it includes relationships that are sweet and effective. It includes happy creditors. It includes productive work. It includes joy in AA It includes the capacity to be filled with some loving spirit that comes through me to other people. Sanity. Sanity. I guess I'd be safe to be around, wouldn't I? Sanity. And I'm here, and this is where I'd like to go, and the question is, can I get there myself? Well, I've only been trying since I was about 5. I guess not. Is there a power greater than I am that'll take me to sanity? It's an assumption I can start with. It has to be a power greater than me. But then everything is, including booze. Everything is. We have to come to terms with our own powerlessness. It's only in the experience of that powerlessness that we can experience a power greater than we are. Because as long as I can't get my powerlessness, I am doomed to play God. And when I'm playing God, I cannot experience God. And when I'm hoping out there someplace will come a person or an event or a circumstance that will give me what I want, I cannot look inside where Wilson tells us we'll find God. And these steps are extraordinary. They're absolutely extraordinary because they will take us relentlessly to a restoration of that connection. And I never knew that. I had no idea. I loved it in Alcoholics Anonymous from the beginning. I love the meetings. I love the fact that it's safe in these meetings. I love the fact that in these meetings I can have a moment of peace. I love it that in these meetings I can get in the room with you instead of being forever up in my head supervising problems, forever up in my head evaluating. Isn't it interesting that my mind creates a problem and I ask that same mind to try to solve the problem it just created and then wonder why my solutions are worse than the problem? And it's safe here, and we have some relief here, thank God. Because we're with people that, after a while, we get it. And something else happens. You know, Wilson had an interesting little comment he made. First step of Bill's story in this big book. Chapter 1, Bill's story. Page 1. He's in London at the beginning of World War I. He's an artillery officer. He's sort of dining out on that American uniform, and the Britons have taken him into their homes and their hearts, and they're dining them, and they take him to Winchester Cathedral with some other. And he, in that sentence, says he was deeply touched in the cathedral and wandered outside. And he just touches on it and moves. And then starts talking about the verse on the tombstone about the grenadier. Deeply moved, I wandered outside. And then on page 13, he's had the experience in Towns Hospital. He's had this remarkable white light thing happen to him. And he says something that takes us back to the cathedral experience, because he says, I finally understood the meaning of my experience in the cathedral. For a brief moment I had needed and wanted God and was humbly willing to have Him with me, and He came. But soon the sense of His presence was blotted out by the clamor of worldly things, mostly those within myself. And this is our cathedral. And we have all had cathedral experiences here. Haven't we? I mean, somebody takes a chip. Somebody says something. You're with somebody and there's just a moment. And we have that experience of being deeply moved. And we wander outside. But we have to look at what that means, you know. I mean, it's blotted out by the clamor of worldly things. Stop for cigarettes, and the guy gets a little snippy with you, and it's, you know. But we have tasted the honey. For a brief moment, we've been humbly willing to have him with us, and he came. And he came. And he always does. And you sit in the meetings for a few years, and you taste the honey, and you become a seeker. And a seeker, and we're all seekers, man. A seeker is someone who has been touched by God in such a way that nothing less will ever do. And you go, God, I guess it just comes unbidden. I guess I'll never really find it. Because we sought power before, didn't we? I mean, we're power seekers. All of us. Lack of power is not a dilemma unless you want power. There's people in Sacramento that are not interested in power. Nobody in this room, but there are people like that. And look at all the places we looked for power. Some guy said, my life with all its ruined hours has been a search for him. And the substitutes have gone on and on and on and on because we couldn't really believe that it is so simple as to ask. We think, I thought, and maybe you did, that if I just, and I thought this from the time I was a kid, if I'm just good long enough, God will notice and will help me. But I could never be good long enough. And therefore I just had to hell with it. And you start over. And it's been like that. Until one day, here, in AA, I just knew that the passage of time in AA wasn't getting the job done. Going to lots of meetings wasn't getting the job done. It's important, and I've never stopped going to lots of meetings. But there's something else. I need an answer that's interior to me. I need to find a place inside me where I can go, where God is. And in this chapter to the agnostics, it says that place is deep within. That place is portable. All of the looking elsewhere never got it. But we have to take steps to, we have to come to believe that a power greater than ourselves will restore us to sanity, whatever we conceive that to be. We have to really and truly come to a point where we're willing to turn our wills and our lives over to the care of that power, whatever we conceive that power to be. And each of us does that in its own way. You know, there's a chapter called There Is a Solution. And at the end of that chapter, in the last couple of paragraphs, he tells us the solution. He says, the personal stories describe how each person, in his own way, came to enter into a mutually satisfactory relationship with God. That's the solution, because we wandered. He took the obsession to drink. We will not drink if we ask for that freedom and acknowledge that we can't do it alone. We've been given a weird gift. It's a gift that's, we have the rest of our lives to become comfortable with the gift, is really what it is. I mean, with this mind that lacks proportion and can't think straight, and an ego that underwrites everything the mind does, I'm not going to be real comfortable out there, or real successful, or real happy, until I finally enter into a relationship that bypasses the mind. I've got to finally take step four. I got to look at what? People I resent. Why do I resent them? We're back to power because they seem more powerful than me. What about that fear inventory? Why am I afraid? Because I'm afraid of things that are more powerful than me. What about that sex inventory? Man, there's a power play, huh? Really? She has yes, no power. And how do I handle that? And what do I do in the face of it? And how manipulative can I be? And what games do I play? That's the inventory. It's all about my misuse of an attempt to find my power, which I never could do. And I read that to somebody and I finally see these old ideas that have brought me here. I'm not interested in them anymore. I don't lust. What is that? That's simply an attempt to get power out of sex. That's all it is. Am I willing to have that lust go out of my life? Yeah. Yeah. Take it away. Am I willing to have dishonesty? Does courtesy go out of my... Yes. Yeah. Once we're willing, all we have to do is ask. Isn't that a fantastic story that Joyce told up here at a little conference in Coloma a few years ago? A lady from Reno was talking. Her name is Joyce. And she's got maybe 24 years now, but at the time she had 20. And she was speaking of a time when she was 10 years sober. She was speaking of a time in her sobriety when she was trying to get over her fear of heights, and she decided to take skydiving lessons. Yeah, I wouldn't have done it that way, but she... and she does. That's how she's going to manage that. And the day came, she's supposed to solo out of the airplane, and she's going into the drop zone. And in the drop zone is her husband and her kids and the women she sponsored, and her ex-husband, he's in the drop zone too. I do not know why. And he was in AA. And there was something wrong with the chute, and it never really opened, and she hit the deck going a lot faster than she should have been. And as she stood there and told that story, you kind of got that she lived through it, but she, you know, it's like... And she said she spent the next 18 months in a hospital learning how to urinate again. And it's like, okay, I get that. And in that time, her husband left her. But her ex-husband came back into her life, the guy in AA, and he's in her room one night. And they're talking in her hospital room. And he finally got around to the question. How come you did that? She said, you mean the... He said, yes. What is that? And she said, I was... You know what it was? I was just trying to get over my fear of heights. And he started to laugh. And she said, what are you laughing about? And he said, all you had to do was humbly ask. And I'm going, Jesus! How many airplanes have I jumped out of? You know? Man, I mean, it gives you, there's such power in step seven, and all we have to do is be willing. You know what willing means, incidentally? It means, not what I thought, it means, look it up in the dictionary, it means gladly ready. Whoa, that's, I thought it meant gun to the head time. Gladly ready. Am I gladly ready to give up these things? And we do eight, and we get on the road to do nine, those direct amends. There's such healing around it. I knelt at that grave in Montana. I thought I'd never get out of that cemetery that day. I get up to go to the car. A guy was waiting for me, and I'd turn around and go back and kneel down and weep and weep. And I'd be done, and I'd get up, and I'd turn around and go back. Because I had never gone back, and I was never going to go back, and I'm in the cemetery on a warm spring morning in Billings, Montana, at the grave that I couldn't cry at so many years ago. And I came out of there. That guy was so good that was with me. He'd turn on the engine and he'd turn it off. He did that five or six times. But I came out of there trusting, loving. I can't see, I've been living out my second and third choices in life. My first choice is to trust and to love. And it turns out that's the power. I knelt at a grave in Roanoke, Virginia, where my father, who had been such a cruel alcoholic, was buried. I went to Denver and I went to Portland and I went to Seattle and I went to the women I had married and to the children that were mine and to the bosses and the employees and to the people to whom I owed amends. And it is possible to go to every one of them or kneel at their grave or write them a letter if you don't know where they are. And there's such power that comes out of that, because to walk in this way clean and at resolution with everybody is an amazing experience. Then it brings us back home. It brings us back home. It gets to be about obedience. And the opportunity came to raise a little boy. And I did that. I didn't want to do that. I did that. And he and his mother went on their way, but I answered the call. Recently, the opportunity came to honor my father because somebody has come into my life for me to honor, a man, older man, a mentor type. Okay, all right. Do I want to do it? No. Is there great reward and sweetness in it? Yeah. Yeah. I have a woman in my life that I love and I trust. And I could never do that before. It's about love. It's about, you know what? I don't love her. God loves her through me. God is love and God works through people. And my job is to be available so that God can love her through me. And God loves me through her. God loved that child through me and me through the child. And we're here to love one another or to allow God to love the other person through us. And so if you're new, we love you, and we're glad you're here, and there's great healing around that. Not your healing, our healing. It's the love you give that heals, not the love you get. But the great thing about this deal is if you stick around, if you're new, you'll see someday, soon, in a meeting, sooner than you think, somebody that's newer than you. And they will sit down beside you, and you will find yourself totally against your will and against your expectations. You will find yourself loving that person. And your healing will begin. And for more than 61 years now, we've called that Alcoholics Anonymous. Welcome home.